Welcome to the Wine Club, episode 10. I got it wrong in the actual podcast, so I apologise for that right now. Today's guest doesn't need an introduction, but to those who do need an introduction, we have special guest Sean Goff, a 57-year-old skateboarder who's been shredding since 1976. Despite the aches and pains he's experienced with weak shoulders and stiff knees, Sean still manages to skate better than most, including me. In this episode, we dive into the history of the UK skateboarding, exploring some of the most bizarre skate trips he's been on, adventures Sean has been on throughout his skateboarding life. We'll also hear about the unexpected sideline as a gravedigger and his encounters with legendary skater Tom Penny, which I had to put in because apparently everyone asked Sean Goff about Tom Penny. Episode 10. Enjoy.
Who are you guys working for?
Who is this?
It's Skate Wine.
Oh, beautiful. Did you say Skate Wine?
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Hello, welcome to the Wine Club, episode, I think it's 9. And today's guest, the legendary Sean Goff. Hello, Sean, how are you?
Hi, Rob, how's it going?
Good, thanks. You've just got back from Bowlzilla?
I just got back from babysitting, to be honest with you, but about a week ago I got back from Bowlzilla, yeah.
Amazing.
In Australia, that's really good. Australia and New Zealand.
Before I forget, I've got to get the ball rolling, and I'm really interested in your answer, and I know that you've been listening to the podcast. If you were a beverage and you were a wine bottle or any beverage, what would you describe yourself as?
I would describe myself as, that's a really stupid question, and I've seen it on every single podcast, and I've thought, is this supposed to be a way of breaking the ice? How random is that? It's like, you should ask, what's your favourite drink? I mean, I get it, it's skate wine and you're trying to play with words and you're trying to be funny, but you've got to remember that you're not. So I'm just going to say wine gums.
I knew wine I'd get gums,
it's kind of like a kiddie sweet. It's nice. It's chewable. It's non-alcoholic because you haven't got a drink. And it's also something that your grandparents would give you. And I'm kind of old, so wine gums.
How old are you now, Sean?
I thought about that.
Huh? You're ready. I knew you'd be ready. But how old are you?
I am 50. Oh, fuck. I haven't got my helmet in front of me. 57. 58 this year. I always have it on the side of my helmet. It's the only way I can remember.
I knew I was going to enjoy this. You are someone much like Eddie, who I've known for ages, but haven't managed to ask or talk about general life things, I believe. So we've just got back from Bowlzilla. How was Bowlzilla? How was it the first time travelling in 3 years?
It wasn't my first time. I went to Norway before for the Chamonix Skate Gala, but it's the first time out to Bowlzilla again in a very long time. And no, it was good. It was good to get out there. It was good to just say, can you swear?
Yes, of course you can.
Good, I won't. It's just good to say goodbye to all the quarantine stuff, you know, and actually get out there and see your friends and things like that. So it was fun traveling out there. No restrictions. I kind of wondered if there would be, you know, you look on the websites, you're kind of worried, but it's all good. I think everywhere apart from America is kind of sensible now. So yeah, it was good. Get out there, hang out with Chad. Bowlzilla contest in Wellington in New Zealand was amazing. Beautiful weather. Then we went to the Gold Coast in Australia after that, and then Nimbin the week after that, which was really good.
When was your first Bowlzilla? When did you get invited to MC it?
Oh, okay. I didn't MC the first ones. I kind of went out to Bowlerama was the first events I went out to, and that's was Bondi, and that's kind of massive. That's where Pedro was a young kid, up and coming, and all these things. And the way I got invited to MC these events is because at Bowlerama, Chad and Sergi were double dipping. Now, double dipping is a term that they used for you're paid to go there to MC, but you're entering the contest as well to try and win some money because there was prize money down to like 20th. So they were both double dipping and they both made the final. So there was no one to MC because in the prelims, they were taking turns.
No
and
way.
You usually figure no one's going to make the final. And it was my first, maybe my second year out, and I still hadn't sussed out the pool because it's a tough one. And Chad's wandering around with a microphone going, does anyone know how to MC? Can anyone MC? And I'd done a few vert series. I'd done it a bit. I was like, I can give it a go if you like. He looks at me a bit worried and he just hands me the microphone. And he's like, you know how to do it? I'm like, yeah, of course. Yeah, let me just warm up the crowd. And Bondi's massive crowd, you know, it's a big crowd. And I was like, okay, ladies and gentlemen, who's ready to see the final? Here we are. And you could see Chad's like, relax because he knew I could do it. But for me, there was another reason that I wanted to do it is because when you're watching the pro final at Bondi, it's packed. Like, you find a spot by the bowl and you are jammed in there and you don't want to move because someone else is going to take that spot because this is the best, world best skating in the world. But now I've been given a microphone. I can wander around like this, stand in front of everybody because I'm in charge of the MCing. So great, I had the best seat in the house and I just MC'd that. And I kind of helped out a fair bit for, I think, another couple of years at Bowlerama. Then when Bowlzilla happened, Chad invited me out to help out there. So, yeah, glad to do it. Glad to be invited to the New Zealand National Championships and to be invited to the Australian National Championships and to never be invited to the UK Championships.
When did you... I love that.
From years and years ago, they appreciate me. Just the new people who don't appreciate me.
When did you first start MCing? Because I remember I first met you at the Vert Series and you were MCing the Vert Series. When did you step from being pro skater to start MCing as well?
Step from, like, there's a solid divide. You can skate good now, but oh, you can't. Now fuck off and talk about it. No, basically I was doing demos for Peter Noble's company, Team Extreme. Like, Danzy was involved, and it was BMX and roller skate and blah, blah, blah. And one of the riders always MC'd the events. It was weird. The first one I did, I hated it because I had no concept of getting the crowd involved or, come on, everybody. I wasn't that because I'm pretty introvert as a person. So I started doing that, and I was just like, okay, next up is skateboarding. Skateboarding come from back in the day, from surfing. I was very explanatory of the roots and trying to give history. And it's only over time that I've started to get involved, you know, like bring the crowd into it and feed off the energy of people. But I've been doing that, probably 20 years ago, maybe 25 years ago. I don't know.
Wow.
Yeah.
I remember when I was first asked at a Vert Series to MC a Vert Series. I think it was B Group. It was probably A Group or Masters. And I really enjoy and try and mimic your style because it's engrossing, encapsulating. You get the crowd involved. It's fun. You know the skate tricks, which is probably one thing that I don't know so well.
Yeah. You see, I like thinking of it as not just for skaters, you know? Like, a lot of the events, like I did Bowlerama, Bowlzilla, there's non-skaters there, like parents who come along. And I like to have a laugh as well because I know people. And I'm from a generation where you can take the piss out of your mates because you were allowed to take the piss out of your mates. And even people you don't know, you kind of have a laugh with them because, yeah, cool, it's skating. That's what you do. So that's what I would do on the microphone, you know? So I remember the first time, okay, right, you're like this, or you might not, I don't care. First time I MC'd you, and I know it because I remember seeing you and you had a pink helmet on. And I'm like, this guy loves attention, mate. I didn't know you. I'm like, I can take the mickey out of this guy and he'll love it. And I just took the mickey out. Yeah, next up, Rob Aitken wearing his sister's helmet. Great to see he's taking the tassels off this time. And I instantly was ripping into the piss into you, even though I didn't know you. So you can kind of gauge from certain people's reactions how you can take it. And I just enjoy it. I have fun emceeing it. And if people come up and said, oh, that was really funny, or that was a laugh, then that's a bonus to me. Because, you know, it's like, I'd rather make people laugh. It's like a comedy set, but it's not.
Yes.
And knowing about the skate trick helps.
I'll never forget the Vert Attack. That I think it was Team GB when I put up my Olympic gear. And you ripped into me. And so many of the Europeans, there's kind of like a borderline where they don't get some of our humour. And I remember some people coming up to me and being a bit like, do you want a hug? Are you okay? It's like, that's just Sean. Like, this is, it's fine. I enjoy it. It's showmanship.
Yeah. And you probably really did want a hug.
When did you start getting involved in Vert Attack as well?
Don't know. I was probably there a couple of years. Again, with Vert Attack, I remember Sam Bottles was taking a run and Stan Possumus was doing the MCing from the seats for some reason. And I grabbed the mic for him. I said, oh, I'll MC Sam's. And I just MC'd Sam's run. And I guess at that point, they're like, oh, Sean knows what he's doing. Because it's kind of funny. Like, I don't go out there going, yeah, can I MC your comp? I never asked to MC comps. I don't want to promote myself. So I'm an MC, you know? There's people out there like Mark, who's really good. who that's his job. He gets paid that money. Fair enough. I don't want to take that money away from him. So I kind of am found more from by accident. Like I'll just join in because I want the event to be good. Or if someone's doing a really bad job, I'll try and help out, and like join in with them and see if I can get some energy going.
Yeah, there's been a number of little events I've been to where they've been like, "Is anyone MC?" Is it? And I've stepped in. They've been like, "Oh, okay." And again, that comes from listening and understanding people like yourself and Mark, who are really good at it. Which has been your most? I'm assuming you're going to the Vert Attack coming up at the end of March.
Yeah.
Are you looking forward to that? That's the first one.
I'm on the poster, dude. Oh. Have you not seen the poster? I'm on the poster. Stan on the poster.
Ah, yes, I have seen it.
None of that skateboarding shit. All those skateboarders, Clay Kreiner, all them guys, they come and go. Me, Stan, Stars. We're on the poster.
I've been shutting it out from my mind because I'm going to miss it, and I absolutely love Vert Attack. So I've been trying to like ignore the posters and all the. But every time I reposted the German guy Wolfgang because this is so many characters that go to Vert Attack, and it's so fun.
Yeah, Wolf is amazing. Such a good guy. Can you remember that year that you did the interviewing at Wolf at Vert Attack?
Yeah, so it was the beginning. Well, it's when they had the live stream, and I did the questions. I did the questions one year, and then the second year, I remember I got taken the mick out of because I was asking maybe not the best questions, but you learn from these experiences. But yeah, which has been your favourite Vert Attack so far? Most memorable?
I think the ones after you were doing the questioning. Once you stopped doing that and you weren't there, it got a lot better. Like the whole atmosphere, you could feel it. It kind of rose and, you know, it was a lot better. It's kind of, okay, Vert Attack's kind of weird because every year's really good. And you kind of go, it's got to the point where you think, it's got to start getting worse. So shall I stop going? Because I don't want to be there at the downfall. You know, you don't want to see a band when they're starting to sound shit. You don't want to be at a comp when it's going downhill. But it's, I mean, the year that Clay was there, the year where the girls' finals was manic, like they skated way harder than the guys, like Brighton Zuma was snaking everybody. That was really good. They kind of all blend into one. Like the first year we went to Vert Attack, we went there thinking the comp was on Sunday. We were skating, I can't remember what it is, this park in Copenhagen. And we get a phone call going, "Where are you guys? Where are you guys?" Because the comp was on Saturday and we went there on Saturday. So we literally arrived during this comp. We were snaking everybody's runs. And then we got like loads of us got in the finals. And that was really good because that was like, fuck me, the Brits are here. And it was kind of Vert Attack after that year was when everybody started coming because they saw it was a fun contest. We'd gone out there. Okay, the Brits are coming. Fuck it, we're going next year. And it just grew and grew and grew.
I remember Wingy used to send out an email to all the Vert series guys at the very beginning.
Yeah.
And that absolute incredible event. What are you most looking forward to this year's? I mean, for 4 years hiatus.
I think the 4 year hiatus is really good because I wouldn't be surprised if John was getting a bit over it. Because, you know, when you're running something, you've got to try and up your game. You've got to try and get it better and better each year. And it's hard when you're doing a really good job. It's harder to do that. So I think John might have been at that point where he's like, "I'm going to stop this." But because COVID hit, and then everyone's like, "Fuck, I want to go to Vert Attack. I want to go to Vert Attack." Now everyone's super eager. Like everyone wants to go back. So I think this year is going to be really good. And going by the hotel situation, the first hotel's already booked out.
No.
They've had to get another hotel to do sub things. So I think there's going to be so many people there.
I'm so jealous.
It's insane. Yeah.
So but jealous. I've
kind of messed up because I go out there with Jim Skin and I'm going out with a Joe and Jim always books the tickets and I get the accommodation sorted out. And he's booked the ticket on the wrong day. We're flying out on Thursday, which we thought was the right day because it's been so many years we forgot. Like the Masters is on Thursday. So we get there and have to skate if I'm going to enter. But I'm not really worried about entering the contest. I want to go to skate with my mates because this is the only time I'll get to skate with people, you know, like Puttis and all the Euro guys that I never skate with. So I want to skate with them. I don't really care about the contest competing anymore.
I think that's why it's such a great event, because it's semi-serious and it's full laughter, like so much fun.
It's a massive get-together. That's the key with Vertec. It's a massive get-together. If you want it to be serious, I guess it can. But for the rest of us, it's like it's the excuse we need to get our asses into gear and meet each other.
Yes. How long have you been skating with Jim the Skin for now?
I would say probably 84.
Wow.
Maybe 85. A long time. He started doing the comp series a little bit later than me. I think I started ES 82. So yeah, 83, maybe 84. So a very long time. I've travelled to a lot of places with Jim, you know. I mean, we've been to Australia, New Zealand, Turkey, America, France, Spain. We've been to a lot of places together, you know.
What's been your favourite place? I was going to cover where you've been with your skateboarding. Where's been the favourite place to skate? Maybe the favourite place you've been to skate, and also the favourite place to skate now abroad.
That's a really, really hard question, because the things I like to skate has changed.
That's why it's a double-barreled question. Really,
it is a double-barreled question. I quite like the south of France. We're going out to south of France again, because there's Calais-la-Rue, there's Marseille, there's some old spots. They're really good fun to go. Obviously, Australia's really great fun. Australia's really, really good. I enjoy that. Gold Coast has got so many parks, and I always skate different new spots. And I've forgotten the second part of the question. What was it? There's two parts.
What's been your favourite place abroad to skate over your time of skateboarding?
What's been the favourite place? Ooh, don't think I can answer that. I really enjoyed the Newcastle Bowl in Australia. I've had great fun when I've been to the States, but that's a very long time ago. Yeah, tough. I don't know. Everything blends, especially when you get older. Your memory kind of blurs into everything. And I've been skating for way too long, so yeah.
Bringing Australia into this, how do you think the difference between British skateboarding and skate park building and skate parks compare to, I was watching your feed whilst you were in Australia and seeing new parks that I'd not even seen 4 years ago. How do you think they differ?
We're kind of like a third world country. We've got absolutely no foresight in how to build parks. It's insane. Like Pizzy Skate Park, they built an Olympic standard street course, which is basically, you know, everything's symmetrical. You know, if you look down the middle, both sides are exactly the same. There's rails of all different sizes, blocks of all different sizes. It's all advanced stuff. It's designed specifically for the Olympic pathway goal, and it's an amazing park. All the bowls out there are going to be deep, you know, 10 foot at least. Shallow ends, like shallow end at Eleonora is probably 7 foot. Deep ends probably 9.5, and it's only just vert when that's small. Whereas in the UK, if you get anything above 8 foot, it's massive.
Yes.
And it shows by the standard of skating.
Yep.
They really are focused on training out there, you know. They really are focused on training, but their skating is getting ridiculous. Sky Brown's really going to have to watch out this year at the Olympics. I'm not sure if it's Elisa True, but anyway, there's a girl out there who's smashing it, absolutely smashing it, super consistent. McTwist every time, frontside rodeos every time, switch frontside airs, frontside gay twists, loads and loads of stuff. And in the Opens in Bowlzilla, second place was a 9-year-old kid. But not like, oh, it's a 9-year-old kid. 9-year-old kid doing 540s, 9-year-old kid doing backside lip slides to sugarcane in the corner. 9-year-old kid doing frontside nose. It's just ridiculous standard. The standard out there is so, so good.
I was speaking to Izzy Butu about
got
that.
Because they've got really good skate parks. They also have really good weather. But, you know, really good skate parks, challenging skate parks, makes really good skateboarders. Whereas in England...
I touched on it on the last podcast. It was something that annoyed me when I was younger. I'd go to Mount Hawke, and I remember Mount Hawke, everything was huge. Everything was massive. And you've got all these little, and I understand it, but you've got all these little pockets of skate parks that even Biddeford, it's a great training ground, but it's not, nothing's over like 4 or 5 foot for health and safety reasons.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. It is absolutely ridiculous. But that's council mentality. And unfortunately, there needs to be a governing body involved in this country. If we could start a governing body of some sort in this country to actually advise councils how to build skate parks and stuff that's going to be of a standard to get skaters to the Olympics or get skaters to a good European standard. But yeah, it's a shame that it's like that in the UK, but that's just the way it is.
Trying to cater to everyone, which I think can sometimes be a deterrent.
Well, yeah, I mean, they do try and cater to everyone. And the truth of the matter is user groups for skate parks are probably the worst thing you can possibly do, because a user group will always want flat bar, a ledge, and then something else, maybe a handrail, because I like the handrail in the street that I never ever skate, but it looks good in photos. And you can't have user groups. You've got to build skate parks and build them well. And yeah, just hope the skaters are good enough to appreciate them. But you've got to have beginner skate parks as well. I think pump tacks are really good, and we need some more float parks. But
what do you make of the Watford skate park?
Watford one. That's the one with the kind of snake run thing, yeah?
It's got the snake run, really the street one course. I've not been yet.
Okay, I've been. First time I went, great fun. Mini ramp, didn't really think much of the mini ramp. Didn't think a lot of that at all, to be honest with you. Street stuff was absolutely amazing. Obviously, I smashed it. The snake run stuff's good fun. But then the second time when you go back, it's kind of, you start noticing the faults and things, you know? And the snake run, although it's good fun, it doesn't, there's no point you can air and flow. And yeah, it could be a lot better. It's fun. It's good they did it. I think for a street area, they've done a great job. Really good. I mean, I could really pinch my front crooks down the handrails really well. So they've done a great job there. But the rest of the park's a bit lacking.
With regards to parks, how have the parks changed from when... I mean, where did you first start skateboarding, and what was your park or ramp like when you first started compared to ramps now?
Where did I first skate then? I first started skateboarding in the streets outside my house, Rob, on some tarmac, on a fucking roller skate ripped apart, nailed onto a 2x4. That's how I started skateboarding. My first ramps were homemade, bits of plywood, lent against walls, anything you could find, real ramshackle stuff. And skate parks were really quite bad in the 70s, really kinked in it. And then I guess going to the 80s, there was Farnborough Half Pipe, Crystal Palace, all those sort of things, ESE. So it's just 8-foot transition, just touching vert. So kind of like a mini ramp extension would be. So yeah, we started off on really small things, really, and ramps just progressed. And then, yeah, skate parks got bigger and bigger. And yeah.
There's some awesome photos of you skating some really sketchy homemade ramps, I now remember.
Yeah. Well, everything was sketchy and homemade. You know, it's like, they go on about the whole DIY movement, but the thing is, DIY was what we had to do, but we made it out of wood. And it was like, there is no ramp plans. You basically got a piece of wood like that, and that was the bottom, and you got a bit of ply there, and another bit of ply there, and another bit of ply there. So it's like, wooden coping. It wasn't coping. Everything would flex. I mean, it was just, it was a necessity to have something like that because there was nothing else. And because we'd not known better, it was fine. You know, you just got on with it.
We're kind of spoilt now with skate parks.
There's skate parks everywhere.
We've taken your DIY skate spots to vert. How did you go from skating in the streets to then start skating? I mean, what would you say you primarily skated back then and in general?
Anything.
Anything.
Yeah, that's what you did. Back when I started skateboarding, there wasn't street skateboarders. There wasn't this, that, the other. You skateboarded. You were a skateboarder, which is a hard concept for a lot of people to understand. But I have a skateboard. I will ride whatever's in front of me. It's not like there was tons of tricks or anything like that. So you just rode what you rode. And like I say, ramps were what you wanted to ride. I mean, you'd do tic-tacs, you'd do a bit of freestyle, but nothing much. And the local council had a fiberglass vert ramp. And that got shut down pretty quick. So I kind of rode that, and I bought that off the council for like 25 quid.
What?
And yeah, you just got into ramp skating because that's what you wanted to do. And by the point that I started doing anything, I was probably the only guy in Oxford skating. So no one goes through dead days of skateboarding. Like, there was probably a time then there might have been 40 people in the whole of the UK skateboarding.
Wow. What time is this?
80? About 1980? Yeah. The 70s craze died. Anyone who carried it on after the 70s craze was pretty fucking hardcore because there was no one about. And then, it, you know, the 80s, it started slowly getting bigger until the whole Back to the Future movement.
Right.
So yeah, skateboarding was really dead. And we wanted to ride vert because that's what you wanted to ride. You know, you're not going to go out skating a curb on your by your own. Not in those days.
You've seen a number of comes and goes with the skateboarding then over the years.
Yeah, it used to go in 8-year cycles. Pretty much it was an 8-year or 9-year cycle. But we've just had the COVID boom where skateboarding went, and then it just died. Like we've had the quickest boom and death of skateboarding there's ever been for a very long time. I mean, like now I say skateboarding is kind of dead. It's probably still busier than it was in the earlier part of the 80s when it was just starting to boom again, you know? But retail wise, yeah, it boomed and died really quickly.
So how was having your own ramp? Did you have people over and did you have any competitions on that ramp?
Yeah. I had part of the English series went on my ramp. And you got this ramp as well, okay. It's a fiberglass ramp, so it's battered and patched up. The flat bottom is made of pallets and old shuttering plywood that used to be a chicken shed. Like not even new shuttering plywood, so it splinters everywhere. It's an absolute nightmare of a ramp, but it was one of probably only 5 ramps in the country. So that's why it was there, you know. Like I say, necessity. In the old days, it was, about necessity. In the old days, everyone reminisces how they were great, and they are really, really good. But that's because skateboarding is different to me than would be to you, because your old days, probably like, meh, to me.
Early 2000s.
You know, Yeah, I used to skate in this year. But it's great. That was like 15 years into my skateboarding. Go to bed, kiddie.
What year was it?
Skateboarding's different for everybody.
What year was it when you first got a sponsor then? Was it in this when the first boom happened in the 70s then?
No. 70s, I was pretty crap. Just your normal kick turns on a polyprop, that's it. You know, 70s, there weren't tricks. You kind of just kick turned as high up as a kink bowl, you could kind of. If you were good, you might have to do it. I got sponsored. Well, my first thing I got given was a deck from a company called Rolling Stock. Well, not a company. It was a skate shop in Warrington. And that was probably about 83, maybe? Something like that. And the deck was crap. But it was a new skate shop. They just opened before. It was just Alpine Action and Surrey's. And this new skate shop opened. Here you go. There you go. 3 skate shops in the whole of the UK. Yeah. Like, okay. Skate shop. Okay. I've got to tell you, forget the sponsorship bit. Let's move that out of the way. Back in the day, when you ordered skateboards, you contact this company, you'd write to them. People don't know what writing is when you get a pen and a paper and that. Put it in an envelope, post it to this shop, ask for a price list. They would send you a price list. I remember getting a price list from Surrey Skates and ordering a tracker t-shirt. Okay, now, no pictures, just the word tracker t-shirt. So I ordered that, delivery within 30 days.
Wow.
None of this overnight Amazon stuff. I had no idea what color it would be, no idea what design it would be. You just pick your size and paid your money and that was it. That was skateboarding back then.
That's incredible.
Could you imagine kids doing that now? Yeah, I want to buy a skate shirt. Well, that's 20 quid.
And it's there.
What design is this? I don't know. We'll get it in a month.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was it. That's what skate. Yeah. So it was a lot different back then. Yeah. And that was a sidetrack. Can't even remember what I was speaking about before, but I remember that little thing and it amused me. It might amuse someone out there.
Well, with regards to that and writing, you made me think when was the, dare I say the first, but when was like skate media and the magazines, when did that take off in the UK?
Well, in the UK, probably 77, maybe 78, skateboard magazine, skateboard scene. Nationwide skateboard magazine.
Right.
Yeah, there's a few different skateboard mags. Didn't come out for long. I think skateboard scene had about 8 issues, skateboard probably about 14. So yeah, they didn't last long, all skateboard media back then.
When was Rad magazine? When did that start? That must have had a few more issues, right?
Yeah, Rad had loads. Rad was... It started off as BMX Action Bike. Because it was a BMX bike that Tim Leighton Boyce worked at. And Tim Leighton Boyce was the photographer in Skateboard magazine, and he worked for Alpine Action.
Okay.
And he wanted to get more skating in the magazine, so he got skateboarding in BMX Action Bike. And I guess that was 86-ish, 85 maybe, maybe 84, I don't know. It's hard. Hard to remember these years, but, you know, early to mid-80s was when Rad came out, and that's probably lasted for a good 6 years.
So that was like the Sidewalk magazine of the 80s then?
Pretty much, yeah. Except I think it might have lasted longer than Sidewalk. No, Sidewalk had a lot of issues, didn't it? Yeah. But Rad probably sold more issues, because back then, you know, there was no internet. That was your media consumption, you know? That's how you wanted to see what skating was. You bought a magazine.
And what year was it when you started appearing in magazines? And you're going to hate this question, but when did you go from skateboarding being this hobby? Because now, of course, it's in the Olympics, so it's just continuously grown over the timeline of you skateboarding. When did you go from, like, obviously your whole entire timeline is enjoying skateboarding, but when was it like, oh, I'm making some money and there's a little bit of a career out of it? What year was that?
Okay. No, there's no career in skateboarding. I made a bit of money
British.
In the 80s, but maybe 1 year I actually made a bit of money, but I still had a job as well. You know, so there was 80s pros. Unless you're in the States, you did not make money. You still worked. You pretty much had to work. But I guess I started getting in the magazines quite early. Yeah, as soon as Rad came out, I was in RAD magazine. I was pretty much in every issue of Rad Mag.
Wow.
Probably. I mean, there might have been one or two in the... I'm talking during the Vert days before... Once Vert died, then forget it, you know. But, yeah, I was in Rad a lot because I was out there skating all the comps.
I was going
to say...
If there
was demos, I'd go to demos.
Was there a Vert series back then?
Was there a Vert series? Yeah, I think the ESA series was still going then. Yeah. English Skate Association, they had a series.
Who was the names back then for me? Because I know you're always having a go at me for the... I don't know any of my skate history pre-80s.
My main competitors would have been Danny Webster, Neil Danz, Barry A. Brook, Lucian Hendricks, Pete Dossett came later. There's obviously Mark A. Brook, Trawler, Ian Cocking, Davey Phillips, Graham Stanners, Jamie Blair. This is where you try and not forget a name. But those are the kind of guys who were A group, you know?
Okay. So there was an A and a B group?
Yeah, A and we've always had... There was always A and B group back then. And I think England's the only country that kind of does A and B group. Because it's... we always figure advanced and beginners. You know what I mean? Well, as into contests, I guess. So that's why it was A and B group back then.
Makes sense.
Yeah, there's a lot of names. I mean, people took it up and stopped pretty quickly. I remember some of the guys stopping in their mid-20s. And then, you know, and it's like, I remember at the time thinking, yeah, mid-20s. That's quite old. Which is insane, you know? That's way over half my life ago.
Did Mike Day ever make any of these Vert series?
ESA series wasn't necessarily Vert. It was skate park. Like, you'd have kiddie pool. It was whatever was right. You know, it wasn't so much Vert ramps because there weren't... This is pre-Vert ramps. So, I mean, kiddie pool was one. There was Barnstable. That was the first time I met Mike. Was it a Barnstable skateboard contest? And he was like king of the bowl because it was his local. But Barnstable bowl was really, really small. And it's quite funny. I remember Jeremy Fox telling me about, yeah, Mike Day used to go up 3-4 foot out of Barnstable. And I'm like, I remember thinking, yeah, these are rose-coloured specs on here. And I've got cine footage of it, and I'm watching this cine footage, and it's like, you know, like maybe a foot and a half, 2 foot, maybe 2 foot on a good day. But then this ramp, this bowl was probably like 7 foot deep, not vert. All the airs were early grab. But Mike skated really good in that bowl, and that's where I remember Mike.
Ben Liddell swears that it's not still there, but if you go to the car park, there is what I think is bowl shape. So I think they just filled it in and it's slowly sunk into the... I'd love it to be dug back up again. Did, was,
Maybe.
When you started skateboarding, who was the pros that were like, who did you look up to when you first started skateboarding?
You'd probably say in the magazines it'd be people like Jeremy Henson, Mark Sinclair, Cy Napper, John Sabosky. I mean, those are like the Benji team, and those are the guys you'd see in the magazines all the time. So they're the guys that you'd have pictures on your wall of, you know, you'd rip up the magazines and put your pictures on the wall. But I do remember the first contest I went to in Bradford, which was maybe 81, 82. And I'd seen an Alpine Action newsletter, which was kind of like a newsletter from this shop. Skateboard magazine had died. So that showed the latest skaters, and they had like Mark Abrick in it and Barry Abrick and Steve Reed, who's now Steve Douglas. And I remember entering this contest in Bradford, and I was forced to enter A group because I could do tricks. And I beat Mark Abrick. And I remember thinking, fucking hell, I beat Mark Abrick, because he'd been in that little newsletter magazine. So I know it's kind of hard to say. You don't really look up to people because you're young. You kind of had, yeah, the early guys. But then as soon as I started competing, I was kind of forced into A group, you know? So you don't really look up. It's like, okay, cool, I'm skating against these guys.
With regards to Jeremy Fox, when was Deathbox? What year was Deathbox born?
Oh, 87 maybe? Maybe 86? I don't know. I'm really bad with years. I've had a lot of them go through this body, so you kind of forget and it all blurs in. I mean, you got to remember, I've been skating since 76, so that's a lot of time and it kind of melds into one. I'm not like an old guy who's like, yeah, back in the day when I skated for the 3 years, I remember all those 3 years because I met Tony Hawk and I did this. But I've fucking been skating far too long now to remember years, but it was in the 80s. Deathbox started in the 80s at some point. 80s.
When was your first pro board?
So you've already asked me questions about when, what year was such and such. I don't know. It's basically after Deathbox was kind of launched.
So
when Jeremy launched Deathbox.
Deathbox was your first pro board?
No, Brand X was.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I had a few boards on Brand X because Jeremy was involved with Brand X. That's how I got sponsored by them. And we went out to the States and he got refused by immigration because they found out he was working there. And then he came back and obviously he couldn't get back in the country and he started Deathbox. And he started off with Wurzel's board and Mac's board. And at the time, I kind of didn't get on that well with the importers for Brand X. So I said, well, you know, I'll ride for your company if you want. And he had no money, basically. Not saying he's paying me, but he couldn't afford basically to give boards. So basically I said, just give me a T-shirt and I'll wear the T-shirt. And it was a Warrington contest. And I won the contest and got pictures wearing the T-shirt and stuff like that. So then people were like, oh, it's Sean on the team. Can we get Sean's board? So
wow.
Basically people were after my board when I wasn't even sponsored by him. So then, yeah, my board was the next one out.
It grew from there. Is that the one with the, like, the star, the sun?
No, it started off because Mac did all the graphics. I never had any input at all in the graphics. It's quite funny how people think you have input. I had zero, like nothing. I think I did the shapes. Did I do my shapes? Yeah, I'm pretty sure I designed the shapes. But anyway, the first one was the tarot card draft graphic. Then they had the ones with the sun. Then there was a double kick, which was east and north winds or something. And there was the ghost train one. And then there's something else I can't remember. But yeah, the sun one was probably the best graphic. That's the one I've kind of got a sticker of and I've got a tattoo of on my back.
Thinking about doing a reprint? Or have you ever done a reprint of them?
No, I haven't. Jeremy keeps talking about them, but
that'd be rad.
It's just that. It's just talk.
Yes.
I mean, there are other reasons, but I'm not going to go into it. But there's been problems with the copyright of the name. But Brand X are desperate to do my reissues, and I've got to do them, but I'm really lazy. Like, they've not got the graphics, but I've got one of each on my board. And they just need high-res photos so they can produce my boards. And they asked about 2 years ago, and I've just not got round to it because I'm really lazy. Which sounds bad because, you know, it's like, yeah, reissue. But it's just I'm kind of lazy.
Well, when you do, I definitely want a reissue with a signed Sean Gough for the wall.
Yeah, that won't happen.
Who else was on Deathbox? Were you the first person on Deathbox then?
No. I've already told this to you, Rob. You're obviously not listening, mate. You need to pay attention if you're going to do these things. The first people were Wurzel and Matt.
Oh, yes, sorry.
Okay. If you rewind it, I actually told you that. Amateurs. I don't know why I deal with amateurs. I guess you've got to give them a hand up in life, haven't you? Then there's Wurzel Matt, there's Mark Vandereng, Pete Dossett, Rocker. These are the English guys, well, apart from Mark Vandereng, who's Dutch. And then, obviously, you went Alex Moll. Later on is Andy Scott, Nordin Kwakbe, Bruno Ruland, and some other people whose names I can't remember. Oh, Jokke. Jokke Olsen. Yeah, there's probably some other people, but my brain can't remember at the moment. But yeah, it was a good Euro team, a good Euro brand, you know. It's a very strong brand. I think people think they sold a lot more than they did. But Jeremy was just very, very good at promoting the brand and getting the riders out there. And he basically suffered a lot for the team. Like, he slept in the warehouse and was breathing in all these toxic fumes, which now are probably banned. You know, he'd basically sleep in the same warehouse that he screen printed decks. And he made bugger all out of it. And luckily he managed to go out to the States and start up Flip and, you know, actually make something out of skateboarding. Which he deserves.
When did Deathbox transfer over to Flip? Was there a, or why? I actually always wondered why did it transfer over to Flip? Why isn't it still Deathbox?
I think because that was the time when skateboard companies were changing their name. Like, New Deal was the deal or End Deal. Companies were just changing their names. You know, the whole Vert thing had died, and Deathbox was a Vert. You know, Vert was big when Deathbox was about. So it was like they were trying to get rid of all the old companies. So I think it changed to DB shortly. It was DB, just short for Deathbox. They put DB on the boards. And Bash, which was like a division of Deathbox, that's kind of where Flip changed. Like, Bash changed into Flip. Oh, okay. And then Deathbox kind of just vanished. So it was kind of, yeah, just that era when Jeremy went out to the States.
Were you ever on Flip?
Which was probably about 92. I mean, Jeremy gave me boards. But yeah, I mean, I kind of had a ball on Deathbox, so that was it. I remember at the time it was South Sea Pool contest, and I really wanted to win this contest. And because I, at the time, I decided, because Vert was dying, and I could see, like, on the cards, it's like, yeah, this is pretty much over for all of us on this thing. And I kind of was like, okay, I'd like to win this contest, and then just that's it. But Davey Phillips fucking beat me. But he's getting really good. No, but But Davey beat me, and after the comp, I told Jeremy, I'm like, yeah, just don't bother making my board anymore. And he went, thank you, because I don't think I can afford to make any Vert Riders boards anymore. I'm like, yeah, no problem.
The brutal truth coming from Jeremy.
Yeah, well, to be honest, that's fine. I kind of knew it anyway. You know, I'm not going to hang on to some, oh, I still want to be a pro. It's like, it makes no difference. And I could see he wasn't making any money anyway, so why should he lose money because of my ego? I didn't have that ego to want him to lose money, so it's fine.
With regards to having, as you said, a non-career in skateboarding, what were you doing during this time to keep your skateboarding passion going?
Okay, well, to start off with, I used to work in Boots in the stock room. This is my jobs. I started off YTS's, okay, and then I got a job working in Boots in the stock room. And this is probably mid-80s. And I remember I was there for about 6 months and I asked for some time off. Like, I'd had a holiday. I asked for a weekend off so I could go to Munster for the World Champs.
Yes.
No, I didn't tell them that. I just wanted to go to Germany. And they're like, oh, no, we can't do that. I'm like, well, yeah, but I want to go because it's the World Championship of Skateboarding. It's like, no, we can't give you time off for that, I'm afraid. And I went, oh, okay, then. Well, I resign. I quit. Oh, okay. I quit, and I tell everyone else. I remember telling the people I worked with, oh, no, I'm quit. It's like, oh, what are you going to do? I went, I don't know. I might go to America. What? And then I went to America for 3 months straight after Germany. And then when I came back from that, I did a bit of self-employed industrial cleaning, which was great fun because my dad used to work for this paper mill. He was hyping that, and then he got involved in industrial cleaning, and we went and stripped asbestos off these machines. It was great fun.
No way.
Yeah, it's kind of gnarly. I mean, I only found out later, like my dad found out. And obviously he felt guilty as fuck because, you know, it's like you just put your 16-year-old child in a position. And I'm like this, like asbestos is here. I'm on my back going like this.
With no mask.
I'm not like, crappy face mask, but not amazing. You know, I mean, you know, it's, and I remember years later, this is probably only about 10, 15 years ago. I'm like, oh, I'm going to check because my dad told me the story. I was like, oh, okay, I'm going to have to check this because he thought he had asbestosis, you know, like on the lung. So I went to hospital to get a check because I told him, I'm like, look, this is what's happened to me when I was younger. I'd like to know. And now, okay, so they sent me for a checkup. And I remember meeting one of the skater's parents there and they're like, oh, why are you here? I'm like, oh, I'm just going to check to see if I've got asbestosis. I used to work with them. She's like, oh, I hope not. I'm like, yeah, me too. But I never had it. Luckily, I never had it. Told my dad, which I think was probably a big weight off his mind. I mean, you can't tell it because my dad's old school, you know, never tells you he loves you, stuff like that. That's the generation he's from. But I could just tell that it was one of those things in his brain. It was like weighing on him, you know, whenever it was mentioned, as it would be. So anyway, yeah, that so I did that for a short period of time.
That's crazy.
Yeah, well, we were harder back then, you know. Munching on asbestos bars, quick fucking, you know, drink of plutonium. Back in the day, we were hard. Nowadays. Yeah, so after that, I was a grave digger. I worked for the council for 2 years. I was a grave digger. Yeah, that was good because you worked outside all the time. You don't dig as many graves as you think you're going to dig. It's all dug by hand as well. So that's kind of fun. And it's kind of weird because you watch programs and you're like, yeah, that's bullshit. You don't dig graves like that. And there's probably only a few people who know that. You know, it's just kind of weird that, oh, yeah, I've done this.
Is there any weird stories from when you were a gravedigger over those 2 years?
Okay, right. There was a guy. This is one that the bloke told. The funny thing is, yeah, one of the guys who worked there was this guy who actually had a hunchback and dodgy teeth. Like, he looked like a horror movie gravedigger. And he'd obviously got given the job because he was one of those people who's never, ever going to work anywhere else. And he used to wear wellies all the time. And he fucking stunk. But that's not the story, although that's kind of funny. The story, and these guys told me, it's kind of weird because it's weird. With graves, like when I first went there, you kind of walk over people's graves. Because it's no big deal because you have to mow grass, you have to do all that. So you kind of get used to it. It's just a grave. You dig a hole, you put a box in it, you cover it up. Blah. Now, graves are traditionally 6 foot deep. So you dig them down 6 foot. And then if it's a couple, you use 6 foot. And then if it's a husband or wife, the next one up goes 4 foot. Okay, so if the grave digger before you is a lazy bastard, they only dig 5, so you're digging down. So this guy's digging down, and all of a sudden, boom, it collapses. Now the rotten wood of the previous coffin is caved in. He's dropped by 1.5 feet. He's gone to get out. His boot has got caught in the rib cage.
Oh no!
The skeleton or whatever is there, and the wood. Now he's fucking screaming and shouting. This is like 4.5 foot deep, maybe foot. No, probably 4 foot deep, 3 foot deep, whatever. Someone has to dive in there, stamp everything down. So they're stamping down the body to grip cage so this guy can get his thing. He leaps out the grave, runs offside, doesn't come back. That was it. That was his grave digging career done. That was on his first week. He was done.
Wow. Did that happen to you?
It's kind of weird. No, I mean, I've dug down and gone, oh, that's the coffin. Like bits of rotten wood. Because you remember, it's wood. Wood in wet mud's going to rot really, really quickly. I mean, especially when humans are put in the ground, they're just compost, you know? You're going to be compost. You're going to be worm food. There's nothing nasty, you know? It's like, ugh. What else do you want your body to do?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Feed some worms. Feed the soil. It's great. It's eco. It's friendly. But, No, I've felt coffins go junk. I've had graves cave in on you. Like you'll be digging down, all of a sudden the sides will cave in and your legs have been trapped. So you have to have metal skirtings along the side. So they started doing that. Most of the time, you wouldn't bother putting them in for health and safety because you're like, it's only 6 foot. My head's going to be sticking out. Someone's going to come and get me. It never happens, but you know, just in case, you might get it down to your knees. But yeah, it's kind of weird. I've buried, you know, in James Bond, there's, I can't remember his name, if it's Blofeld. He's one of the villains with the cat.
Oh, yes.
You know? I buried him.
No way.
Took his grave, put the mud back on top.
That's a really weird clang.
Yeah, it's good, isn't it? Yeah.
And I have to say, while people are listening to the podcast, they've learned something. Don't walk over graves because you might end up 6 foot under.
No, that's never going to happen. Basically, you dig this, but it's kind of funny because when you, so when you're digging a grave podcast, when you're filling the grave back in, okay, because you've got to make sure the mud goes all the way down the side of the graves. Okay, so you have to wait for the people from the funeral to leave before you start putting the mud in. And then you put the mud in and then you jump on top and you jump up and down to push the mud down. Otherwise, there's loads of piles. So basically, you're jumping on top of a grave. So it's kind of weird. And I guess nowadays it's all done with JCB, so they'll probably just pat it down with a JCB so it doesn't look as offensive. But it's one of those things that when you first do it, you're like, whoa. Because I remember when I was a kid, you know, I'd go to a cemetery with my parents. It's like, you don't even walk across the grave because it's disrespectful. And there we are. But jumping down to pat it all down because that's what you have to do.
I don't know whether I want to get cremated or buried now with that story. What happened after your grave digging then?
After grave digging. What did I do after grave digging? Might have been when the shop started. Yeah, perfect. Pretty much. SS20, I guess. Yeah.
That was one of my questions. Yeah. So this is where you started SS20 then?
I didn't start SS20. Mom Barber and Dave Furno started SS20. And I basically started working there from the get-go. And within 3 months, I bought into the company because, they just needed more stock. And I had lots of stock, you know, stuff given to me from sponsors that I'd put in there and sell it and get the money out. And then in the end, it was like, well, they needed someone in there to have more money to put in there to buy stock. So, yeah, after 3 months, I bought into that.
Did you ride for them as well then?
What, SS20? Do you ride for something that's your own?
Like,
do you ride for Skatewine?
That's a good point.
Or are you Skatewine? You know what I mean? It's like,
okay, did SS20 have a skate team?
It did have a very good skate team. I mean, when you consider, okay, I'd have been on the skate team because it's mine, so you would be. Same as Stacey Peralta would have been on Paolo Peralta because it's his team. Like if you think Alex Mole, Tom Penny, Danny Wainwright.
Oh, wow. Okay.
You know what I mean? You just name three people. They're like, you know, Ollie, highest Ollie, you know, Tom's, everyone knows, Alex knows. So, yeah, SS20 had a really good team.
Borderline with Flip then, I guess.
Pretty much. Well, I kind of got, because I knew TLB from the magazine, I got Tim to come down and take photos of Alex because I saw Alex and I'm like, yeah, this guy's going to be big. And likewise with Tom, I got Tim to come down and take photos of Tom because I'm like, this kid's really going to be big. So, yeah, and then they get on to Flip because I know him. I tell Jeremy, you want to sponsor these kids because they're going to be good. And that's kind of how it happened.
Wow. So when did you first meet Tom Penny then? I assume you must have been...
I didn't ask that.
I didn't know. It wasn't a question. It wasn't a question I had.
No, but it's people always do because, oh, Tom Penny, that's a name. That'll get the views. Fuck that old guy. Tom Penny. Let's get the Penny fans. Okay, right. No, I met Tom because Tom was a little annoying kid who come from Summertown area, well, that sort of area in Oxford. Now, my first Tom Penny memory is there's me and Lee Ching. We were going street skating in Oxford and we were by the science banks and there was Tom Penny and Aaron Shellis. And this was when Tom still pushed Mongo.
Oh, wow.
So he's a little kid and he's like, can we come skate with you? You know, like a little annoying 11-year-old voice. We were like, yeah, if you can keep up. And we just fucking hacked it away from him as fast as we could because he was annoying little shit. But, yeah, Tom got good really quick. And I used to take him to Radlands all the time, and yeah, you know. Tom's just Tom. I've known Tom for a long, long time. Okay, Tom Penny trivia for you.
Oh.
Once I phoned up my nan, yeah? Phoned up my nan. Phone rings. Dring, dring. Hello? I'm like, is that you, Tom? Is that you, Sean? Like, yeah. What's the... Hey? The last two digits on the phone number from my nan and Tom Penny switching round.
No way.
Small world, isn't it?
That's amazing. That's absolutely incredible. Yep.
Really random.
I'm just going to let you know that there's a crazy storm that's decided to happen. So if I cut out, it's because there's been an electricity cut out or whatever. It's crazy. Yeah. The weather's just gone buff.
Okay.
Going back to SS20, when did you start Todd Twist? Because I am interested in some of the stories from Todd Twist.
Basically, what happened is I kind of was doing a lot of work in SS20. I kind of did the books, I did the buying, I did all sorts of stuff, you know? And I kind of saw how eBay was going. And I was selling some of my old random stuff on eBay. And I was like, well, I might as well sell a bit of other stuff, you know? So I'd buy stuff from Chris at Shiners and do all that. And I was doing that on the side, but working at SS20, you know? But it's like, I have a family. I need to make money. This is my little side hustle. And Mon at some point went, look, you've got to decide. You can't do both of them. And at one point I was thinking, yeah, well, maybe I could do, you know, half SS20, half off Todd Twist. Because, you know, they weren't competing against each other. SS20 never had an eBay shop. Mon just said that. And I'm like, all right, well, I'll leave then. I'll just do it myself. And then I just went full time into eBay. And I even remember people like Ali Barr, who was a rep. He's like, you're not with SS20 anymore. I was like, no, I'm doing this on eBay. He went, oh, don't worry, something will come along.
And he's still doing it.
It's just like, something has, mate. I've been doing it for like over 15 years. Well, probably 16 years. I don't know what it is. So yeah, I've just been running fully on eBay for a very long time. No rent or rates to landlords. You know, stocks in my attic, in a little lockup, in my mum and dad's attic, in Claire's mum's attic. So yeah, you know.
Everywhere. Oh, shit. I think the internet has just died. We're coming in. The weather's actually not that great today either, to be honest with you. But we're coming in because the Thunder stopped play on Tuesday. So here we are on Thursday. Thank you again, Sean, for joining me for part two. So we did leave it off with the Todd Twist store and how that was going with running that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I can't remember exactly what I said, so it's kind of weird to actually blend into it.
That's right. My question to you after that was going to be, do you have any funny stories of customers whilst you've been doing your eBay store?
It's not so much funny stories of customers. I guess customers on the whole, the customer is always stupid. Okay. I've got that on a sticker that's on my desk. Now, it's obviously not true to all of them, but a lot of them can be really stupid. Like you get classics, like someone will buy, I don't know, like, I want to order these pair of shorts for my son. Will they fit him? And it's like, measure your fucking son, you know? How am I supposed to know stuff like that? And I've had someone actually wrote and complained because they bought some gold fixings off me, like, you know, gold-coloured fixings, anodized gold. And they complained because when they got scratched, the gold didn't go all the way through the bolt.
I remember this because you said that metal isn't coloured. And I was like, metal's not coloured?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I know. It's like they expect it to be like a stick of rock where the logo goes all the way through it, the colour goes all the way through it. Yeah, some people are really, really thick. You know what I mean? I had some guy buy a deck off me and complain because the graphic was not the same as on the picture. And then they messaged me back going, actually, I've just turned over the deck and I've seen the graphic was on the other side. This is 2022, 2023 orders. You know what I mean? People, yeah, it's scary. Considering when I, you know, back in the day at FSS20, you would send out a deck wrapped in paper so it could quite possibly get scratched or whatever it is. No one cared because they put that skateboard on some trucks and rode it. But nowadays, with all the collector's market, you've got to make sure everything is immaculate. Everything's exactly the same. You know, even things like wood grain, people have complained, oh, it didn't look like that in the picture. It's like, well, yeah, that's a stock image. Oh, I don't like the color of the grain. It's a tree. They've not yet devised a way of growing trees, so they're exactly the same when you cut the grain.
Have you ever heard the Asda phone call where the guy's complaining about pizza with no toppings, and the ending is that he turns it over and he realizes he pulled it out of the cardboard backwards? That instantly, when you're telling me about the deck, it reminded me of that straight away.
Yeah, it's insane that people are actually like it. Like they bought they'll I've had complaints where they've bought a set of wheels and the graphics have started rubbing off when they're wearing using them. And obviously, you know, they're going for slappies or whatever it is. The wheels, edge of the wheels go curb. Oh, the graphics coming off my wheels. It's like these are the shit that people care about. It's like, oh, this is why skateboarding is so shit in some aspects. Because these people are involved in it.
Has the vintage market, like the reproduction of older graphics and stuff, has that have you seen that over your time in doing your eBay store kind of ignite more recently?
No, not more recently. It
Okay.
goes through stages. It's quite funny because the reissue boards kind of were completely dead. You know, you couldn't get anything. Then that sort of kicked off. Then it slowed down. But now people are buying them, not so much because, oh, I want the board that I used to have when I was a kid. They're going, I want something that might be an investment.
Okay, that's
Because
interesting.
they've seen people sell boards and think, oh, okay, well, they've managed to sell it for more in years to come, you know? And in reality, if you look at it, I mean, skateboarding has art. Art is pretty good. Like, you buy a deck, costs you, say, 60, 80 quid. You pop it on your wall, it's there for 6 months. You sell it, you get back your 60, 80 quid, or you might get 50, whatever it is. You buy a poster from Athena of a girl scratching her ass wearing in tennis, you know, that old classic. Can't sell that again. That's it, that's done. Any other pictures you buy from wherever, if it's disposable art, then it's disposed of. Whereas at least skateboard art, you can either skate it or you can sell it on to someone else who wants it and will skate it.
I'd not thought about the aspect of using it like that. I thought people were buying it to put on their walls, but to buy it as an investment, that's super interesting. And I remember, I think my first seeing, dare I say, the first time I saw you in a magazine was when I was at college, and they had graphic. They had the there's an American catalogue with the different board graphics over the years, and your board, a number of boards, were in this book. And I remember being like, "Oh, this Sean Gough, I've heard of him." And
Yeah, people buy it as investments. Like, if you look like Clown did a reprint series of Banksy graphics, because years and years ago they had all the they did some Banksy boards with his permission before Banksy was anything really, and then Don Brider actually kept the proofs, the negatives, like the screen stuff, and they redid some, and the first ones of those sold for thousands, thousands and thousands of these boards. And now, because Clown have got the rights for the one a different graphic that he's done, they just churned out a load of boards with that graphic on.
boom.
Loads of people are buying them, thinking they're investments, but they don't realise that, yeah, there's like 150 of that one graphic. There's 100 on the next one. You know, it's like it might be an investment, but then it might not.
Yeah. I mean, that's what all investments are, I guess.
Yeah, it's gambling. You're just gambling with stuff. And I guess with skateboarding, it's, you know, even if it isn't. You're not going to make any money back. It's costing you 60 quid for a deck. It might be worth 100 quid, but it's just a deck anyway. You can skate it if you're a skater, so it doesn't really matter.
And it looks good on the wall.
Yeah, but I'm pretty much now a lot of the stuff I buy, I do not buy for people to skate on. I'm thinking, okay, if I buy that, will I be able to sell it in 10 years' time or sell it in 3 to 5 years' time to the collectors? You know, will this graphic become desirable?
Yeah,
It's
that's.
quite weird selling skateboards like that, because you know, it's you're selling art as opposed to skateboard products, effectively.
You're not an art dealer.
I'm an art dealer, darling. Yes. I deal in all forms of art.
From our last conversation, I've got a few questions left for you. One of them was one of the questions that I had, knowing that you've done a number of demonstrations and you've been on TV and stuff, which is the strangest job you've had while being a skateboarder?
Strangest. Okay, probably the best story. I was stunt double for Bob Carriage's. And not Bob Carriage's. Okay, this is a program called Surprise Surprise, which had Cilla Black on. Okay, And this was in the dead days. And they had this character called, who was a comedian, Bob Carriages, and Spit the Dog, which was a hand puppet. And now the premises of the program is they would get a member of the general public who's like, yeah, I want to drive something fast. So they would get, like, the end thing would be like a test drive in a Ferrari. Then there'd be some other sports car. But the beginning thing was always something stupid. And they needed Bob Carriages to double for him on a skateboard. So they called the English Skateboard Association, and Derry, my mate's like, yeah, Sean can do that for you. So they call me up and they're like, okay, yeah, we need you to do this. You've got to go along and do some tricks. And then there's a little thing you pull and then a rocket comes on and you go along. It's basically just a firework. I'm like, yeah, I can do that. Sure, okay. Well, what tricks can you do? I'm like, I could do little ollies and some bonelesses and stuff like that. And they went, and you could see him on the phone just thinking, what the hell's that? And they went, can you do a handstand? Yeah, I can do a handstand. Never done a handstand in my life. And I'm like, okay, I'll have to learn a handstand. So it's just funny doing that, like little programs like that. You're like, okay, that's on national TV. My mum sees it, stuff like that. But I've never found it on the internet. It's never actually made it out on the internet anywhere. So that's something that just appeared. Well, it was somewhere, but that's sort of, you know, early video recorder days.
Do you still have your Blue Peter badge?
Somewhere, probably. I've got a box upstairs with random bits of crap in. So I've got a few boxes upstairs in the attic with random bits of crap, you know, like wristbands from festivals and demos and little programs and posters. And I'm pretty sure that would have been thrown into that box.
That's a YouTube video itself.
Well, yeah, Blue Peter was brilliant. I mean, that was real fun to do because it was all live as well. And I think we pretty much made everything, like did doubles and everything. So that was quite good to actually pull off live. But there's other things like Dayu, the Dayu advert. I mean, that was like a mega ramp, you know, like 24-foot transition U-pipe with a roller coaster with an actual car going up and back and forth on. You know, I mean, if you can Google Dayu Lanus skateboard, and you'll probably find it. And it was just fun being involved in stuff like that. And other things that I've been involved in demo-wise, which have been interesting. We did the Laureus Sports Award. Now, the Laureus Sports Award is in Monaco, and that's like the Oscars for sports people. And we went along as part of Team Extreme, which is Dazzy and a load of bikers and rollerblades and stuff like that. And they'd never really seen skateboarding before. And this was a live performance set to music in front of pretty famous people. So basically the curtain comes back, gets drawn back, you know, it's all lights you can't see and the music starts, you're dropping in, it's like synchronized doubles, blah, blah, blah. And we had this routine planned. So everything was to music, but this one guy called Carlo Griggs, who's one of the bikers, he was like, I'm just going to do the best I can possibly can. And he was going for 540s and kind of landing, but going off the bike and the crowd were like, oh, but we still managed to do everything, even with him just wanting to go for glory. We all still managed to do it perfectly timed. And like at the end, we're just like, yeah, it's the music like that. You're looking out. All you can see is lights. You can't see anything. And again, I saw that on TV. And there's like Sean Connery gave us a standing ovation. There's the Principality of Monaco. There's loads of super famous people, wow. You know, Catherine Zeta-Jones, Michael Douglas, like all up on their feet, giving the standing ovations like this. And we only really notice that when we see it on video because you can't see because of the lights. So that was really good. But the funny thing about that, or it amused me, is 3 years later, Tony Hawk went back because that was his Boom Boom Huck Jam era. So Tony Hawk and Rick Thorne and all these amazing people, they do their demo, pans around to the crowd, and the crowd are just like, because they've seen it. We were the first people there. We were the people who blew their minds because they'd never seen it before. They had no concept what skateboarding and biking and everything on a vert ramp was. And these are people who can pay the most ridiculous amount of money to see the best of anything. And we got standing ovation. Tony Hawk just got.
Was that live as well then?
He was second.
When you did that?
Yep. Yeah, wow. That was live.
That's incredible.
Totally live. Again, that's on YouTube. Laureus Sports Awards Skateboarding, I guess you'd have to do for that one, but dig back. But it's one of those moments that you're like, cool, I was there, you know. And you have people like Vinnie Jones walk past us when we're in the locker room, you know, getting changed afterwards, changing room, sorry. But nice show, lads.
No way.
Just random people like that, you know, and yeah. So, yeah, demos have got me out doing lots of different things. And Okay, another one. I'll tell you. If it's not too long, I'll tell you when we're at the Laureus Sports Award, because that's at Monaco. Okay, so that's like the richest people in the world are at Monaco. It's ridiculous, and then they lay on a lot because all these sports celebrities are here and all these famous people to be at this award ceremony. And then there's Sunseeker, which are like powerboats. Okay. And people who buy these powerboats, they buy them so they can be with their yacht because they have multi-million pound yachts.
Right.
And we got invited on one of these Sunseeker boats, you know, like speed boats. And we're like, yeah, we'll have a go. So there's half of the team gets in there and this guy's like, Team Extreme, are you? I'm like, yeah, all right. Do you want to have a go? I'll push it a bit for you. We're like, yeah, definitely. So we go out on this boat. He's like, okay, right. You're going to have to stand up now. You don't want to be sitting down because if you're sitting down, your knee's going to hit your jaw and you're going to break your jaw.
Whoa.
Okay. So he starts accelerating, jumping a little bit like, and one of the guys, one of the BMXers, which is funny enough, Carlo Griggs, who was the guy who went mental, he's like, no, I've had enough. Okay. So he takes him back and the guy looks around. He's like, so the rest of you guys pussies, you're all right for this? I'm like, no, let's do this. So we go out and we're... this guy's hacking it. You can see he's like trying to shit us up because he's already shitted up. You know, he's already scared off Carlos. So he's trying to scare off the rest of us. So he's in this boat. And you know, you see boats on waters, those races, and they're like, and he's doing that. And we're like, whoa, like jumping. It goes, boof, and it goes, turns sideways, like, boof, boom. And it goes like 70 degrees, like turns like that, and lands. And you can see him go, boom, cut the engine like that, like, oh, I pushed it really fast on that one. And I remember looking, I remember being in this boat and looking across at the shore at Monaco and going, I don't think I could have swam that far. You know what I mean? Like, fucking gnarly there. We nearly crashed a really expensive boat. But you know what I mean? You can't, well, you can buy that shit, but you've got to be really, really rich to buy that shit. And that was an opportunity that was given to me because of skateboarding.
Because of skateboarding, that's amazing. I was going to ask you which one had been your most memorable. So if you hadn't already covered a most memorable in all of those, which one would you say is a...
Yeah, no, that's probably was the most memorable one because, you know, there's no way I'm ever going to be able to do anything like that again. I mean, just to get out, you know, just to have someone go out there and rag a, you know, £500,000 boat or whatever it is, just try and jump in wave with you in it. You're not going to get that experience. You can't really buy that unless you're paying a fortune. That was just some dude showing off because, you know, they're selling that stuff to billionaires. So he's got it and he wanted to have a laugh. So that was really memorable. I've done comps that have been really memorable. Like in Turkey, we did a demo for this clothing shop called Vakarama. And they brought us out there and we did demo on this beach. Well, first demo we did was outside the front of their shop and they said, can you send us pictures of a ramp and we'll build it? And we're like, yeah, okay. So Danzy sent them pictures of this ramp and they built a ramp and it was 7 foot tall, 8 foot wide. And we didn't realize this because it's all painted gray with a Vakarama logo. Neil found out on our first show that it was only one layer of really thin ply because he bailed a backside air and put his leg straight through the ramp about 3 foot up. Luckily, never broke his leg. We had to skate. We didn't have to. Oh, I guess we did. Or we just did it anyway, because that's what you do. We skated around the hole as best as we could for the rest of that demo. And then they eventually patched it all up. So it was okay. Still ridiculously small ramp. And the following year, they get us out there. Same ramp, but it's all fixed up. So it's 7 foot, you know, 7 foot tall, 8 foot wide. But they figured out, because the previous year, there were so many people watching, that they're like, we'll just put more flat bottom in. So it probably had about 60 foot of flat bottom. Like literally you had to tic-tac and pump. You could do doubles and cross over like that. And we did a demo there and it was lined all the way, like side to side, rammed with little kids. Little kids with their heads pointing up at the transition like that. So you couldn't bail. You couldn't bail it. It was ridiculous. So that was another really good experience. And cliff diving there as well. And the sea was super warm like a bath. And yeah. That was amazing. Absolutely amazing to get out there again and do that.
Awesome. Awesome. With regards to all these events that you've been covering, with more recent events, I'm going to have to ignore the COVID period. What events have you most enjoyed over the last 4 or 5 years that you've been a part of, that you've been going to? It doesn't have to be one because we're singling them out. But
yeah, you can't really single them out. I really do love going over to Australia and New Zealand just because... it's really good to get out somewhere during the crappy winter greyness. So you get out there and have some sunshine, and people are always really friendly out there, and there's loads of parks. So I really enjoy the, Bolzilla sort of trips. They're great fun. Chamonix for the Skate Gala, that's great. Carl Benny really looks after everybody there, and again, it's a really good scene and a really good culture out there, and everybody's friendly. Just going away with my mate. I kind of enjoy all the trips I go on. That's why I go on them, to enjoy it. If there's a trip and I don't think I'm going to enjoy it, I'm not going to go. So, and there's very few. I've been invited to do MCing work at places before, and I've just gone no, because I don't really know enough people there who are going, or I don't really know the place. So it's like, I don't really want to go. If I'm not going to enjoy myself, or I don't think I'm going to enjoy myself, what's the point?
Yeah, that's true. I don't know how much we can talk about it, but my next one on the list I had was your film. I don't know whether Paul will be happy with us talking about it just yet. I think a question that I will be able to put on and be able to air is, how was it to be followed by a film crew for however many years it did cover? Was that a surreal experience?
It's kind of, yeah, I guess. I mean, you kind of put yourself into it after day one. You're kind of like, okay, I need to do this. I'm supposed to be fly on the wall documentary. They're going to follow me for a bit, but it wasn't that long. I mean, they went over to New Zealand, they were at Mount Hawke. I mean, everything that was hit the other places, Caterham and Greg's and stuff like that, everyone knew they were about. It's just you have to try and block people out.
Yes.
And that's it, really. You walk up the stairs and someone's there with a camera, look, pointing at you. You just don't make eye contact and you just walk up the stairs as if they're not there. It's kind of easy to do. I mean, people have probably been doing it around you all the time, where they just ignore you. They see you and ignore you. And this is basically what everyone had to do with the film.
And with it going through all the film festivals, I believe that it's won or been nominated for a number of awards, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's one of a few things.
Wow.
San Francisco Film, I think San Francisco Film Festival, can't remember the exact name of it. I think it won six awards in that. There's a few things it's got, yeah, nominated. You'd have to have a check on their Instagram, to be honest, because I can't remember. But yes, it's done really well. It's been well received, but it just needs someone like, I don't know, Netflix or whoever it is to take it on.
Pick it up.
But I think because Paul's actually funded it himself, he needs to make some money back. So it's not like you can just give it to a company. It's not
Yes.
like me or you making a video of our mates and going, whack it on YouTube. Let's get views. Views don't pay the bills. Views don't pay back, cameraman's editing suites. I
Flights.
believe there's money to be made back off it. So hopefully he gets his money back, and hopefully it's out there and people can see it, and hopefully they enjoy it.
Definitely. Well, I've watched it a number of times. I think it's a brilliant film, and I wish Paul the best of luck with getting it onto a broadcaster. My final question to round up into the Q&A for you, because I've got a number of questions and I want to try and get this in the 40-minute mark. What's your plans as Sean Gough for the future?
Old, be a granddad.
Keep skating.
What else would you mean? What my plans? Eventually die. I don't know, retire maybe. Be nice to retire. Plan. It's quite weird. I quite often think about plans because the older I get now, it really, really is hard. Escape. Like I touch on that a lot in the documentary, but even in these past couple of years since, so much harder now. It really is harder. Your fitness goes and anything. It gets tough. But for me, I'm just going to skate as much as I can. I like skating with my mates. I like messing around on little things more than skating big things. And yeah, I don't know. Just carry on doing what I've been doing for years.
And enjoying it. Well, you're a massive inspiration to me. You still skate a million times better than me, and I'm half, well, not half, I'm a third, a 2/3 of your age. My maths, quick maths. But you didn't manage to do last night because of Wednesday Night Club. How long has Wednesday Night Club been running in Birmingham?
Well, since it's opened, Wednesdays in Birmingham have been since it opened. Before, it
Nice.
was way before that, we were doing Wednesdays at Worcester in probably 88, 89. And then that carried on to the Radlands days. And then the Radlands days then went on to the Birmingham days. So Wednesday's been a regular night skate for so very long. It's ridiculous. It's only the early 80s. Well, actually, maybe since the 90s. It's only, earlier days that skateboarding was for weekends. Now it's skateboarding is Wednesday night. You go Wednesday nights.
That's brilliant.
Which is really weird because I guess we're the only ones who's just like, you do a full day's work and then you go skateboarding. And yesterday was so hard. Yesterday was, oh, mate, not so much the skateboarding because I'd just come back from Australia, okay? So I'm in my car, I'm on my own. It's an hour and a quarter's drive to Birmingham. So I'm driving along and it's fucking hammering it down with rain and it's dark and miserable. And because it's hammering it down with rain, people are driving like idiots. And I'm driving along going, this is shit, fuck. And I look up, Bree, I'm only in Banbury. I've got another 35 miles to go, yeah? You're just like, oh, this is crap. But then you get there. 15 deep session, you have a great time, it's really good. But unfortunately, it's so far away for me. And once you come back, I always get this when you come back from somewhere really exciting, like a trip abroad, it's really hard to get back into the motivation of skating the same old, especially when you've got to drive for miles and you know it's going to be cold and wet.
I was going to say, do you find it more difficult to skate whilst it's cold and wet than, for instance, when you've just been to Australia and New Zealand in the warm?
Well, yeah, when it's cold, definitely. Obviously, you can't skate in the wet. If it's dry indoors, it doesn't really matter. It's just finding time to skate out here. I mean, obviously, when it's warm, your body is a lot more relaxed. But again, this is what I'm saying from age. This is the first year in Australia where I've actually been woken up by knee pain. Whereas I kind of get woke up by knee pain all the time in the UK, but it's just general pains.
Right.
But before, when I've gone out there, it's been nice and warm and you're not. But at least twice, I remember waking up going, oh, bollocks. Because I'm just at that age now where my body's just going, mate, you're screwed.
And you're still pushing it.
Yeah.
You're still pushing the limits.
Well, yeah, but it's just kind of funny. You say still pushing the limits. I guess you're pushing the limits of what your body can do at a certain age. But pushing your skateboarding, nah, not at all. But it's like, what are you going to do? Just not do anything? Like my dad at the moment's got really bad arthritis and he's in pain, just sitting down. But he's not done anything, you know? And I guess at some point I'm going to be worse than him. But like Claire always tells me, is like, you did this to yourself. Yeah, so if I'm in pain, it's because I've done that to myself. I've made the choice. I've just seen the cat in your background. just noticed that one of your cushions suddenly start moving. It was really weird.
An iPad as well.
So I've done this to myself. So any pain I've done, it's self-inflicted, you know. So I've earned it, and I guess hopefully at least I'll look back as like, well, yeah, at least I deserve this by doing something well.
I remember Pete King being interviewed by a London broadcast company back, this is in the early 2000s, and they said to Pete King, you know, it's dangerous, you could hurt yourself, you could give yourself, you know, conditions that last for ages. And his response, which I think is, especially from myself injuring myself in my early 20s, is he said, you know, you could be doing gardening all your life and picking flowers and stuff, but you could still end up with arthritis when you get to your 50s and 60s from doing nothing. And I think that was such an important point from him. It was like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, 100%. My sister's knees are knackered. Like, she's absolutely knackered, her knees, and she's done nothing. It's just the way it is, you know, because of her weight or because what if she does, I don't know. So it's just, these things can happen. There's no point wrapping yourself in cotton wool and bubble wrap and trying to protect yourself.
Although I did fall.
You might as well live your life. Yeah. What's that as well as bash your head on the sink and all the other things that you do?
It's been a week of it. Lost you from the podcast because of the weather. Yesterday I got pistachio ice cream and that there was a whole blooming nut in there. They hadn't actually taken them. It's just one of those weeks for me, I think, unfortunately.
Third word problems, mate. I'll tell you what, a whole pistachio nut in your ice cream. Fucking hell, man. I can imagine those guys back in the trenches in the early days. At least we haven't got a whole potash nut in our ice cream, they'd say. The bombs flying overhead.
Shell. I meant shell. I nearly broke my tooth. Anyway, onto our questions, because we've got the 10-minute mark. Onto the questions, and we've got so many to run through. The first one is from Gregson1000s, which I'm sure we know who that is. He says, when's the next Workshy session? And when is the weather going to get better? I like that one, like your God.
Yeah, well, when is the weather going to get better? Hold on a second, let me just... No, I tried to shit out some sunshine, that didn't work. Workshy session, well, we might be going tomorrow if his feet are better. He's got problems with his feet. So if his foot feels better and it's dry, we might go for a skate tomorrow.
And the next one up is the Glancy's response. What is your, I think it's meant to be favorite ever ramp in the UK? I like that. That's a good question.
Birmingham. Yeah, favourite's Birmingham, definitely. It's also my most depressing ramp because that's the ramp that I probably skated my best at. And now I skate really, really bad at it. Like you go somewhere and it's a spot and you're like, yeah, I used to be able to go 8 foot. Can't even do airs anymore. Yeah, I used to be able to do this. Can't do that anymore. But it's a lovely vert ramp. Nice, solid, straight walls, no messing around, no tombstones, no channels. But surface, beautiful.
Up next, Gavin Swaffield Photography. A story from a session at Dead Rabbit's Ramp.
Well, can't really give a story from a session at Dead Rabbit's Ramp. I mean, I don't know. I just skated with Don there every once in a while and Greg, but I can't really remember his story. It's bloody ages ago. It seems like he thinks there's a specific story. No idea.
No
But
story.
Dead Rabbit's was a ramp built under a bridge in Southampton area, totally illegal. But yeah, I went there a few times, went there with Molly and Scamp and those guys. So yeah.
Was there any
Not exactly much of a story.
photos in the magazines from it?
Yeah, I think it was in Rad or Skateboard magazine. I don't know. Yeah, there's a few pics at some point or another, I'm sure.
Next
Not a
up,
good story, though, is it?
next up, we've got Dunstan's question. 24. I don't understand this one. 2014 or 2015? Rioja or Rioja?
Hey? 2014 or
2014 or
20.
2015? I don't know whether you can see that.
I'll put on my glasses. Yeah,
No.
I've no idea what that means.
It's gonna be interesting to find the follow-up of that. I have no
None of the
idea.
above.
Is
Yeah.
it Portugal? Do you want a
Do I get it
Portugal
right
trip?
and win £1 million, or is it just.
No idea. There's no like explanation to it either. We'll go on to the next one.
No.
Will Paris's
Okay.
response. Way. Who inspires you? What motivates you to keep rolling?
I get inspired by Wednesday Night Crew. Go up there and skate with all the boys. That's a rad laugh, you know. I get inspired by Ben Gregson because I go skating with him because he's the local guy I always skate with. Yeah, that's probably it. I just get inspired to skate with my mates. You know, I mean, you can't say someone who's really famous inspires you or anything like that. Once you get to my age, it's a case of you get inspired by your mates. They're the people who get you out there to do things, you know? And you have to give people shit sometimes. I got inspired to skate once by Greg. This sounds like really pitiful, but good. Greg once inspired me to go skateboarding because he was like, wanted me to come and skate his ramp. And I'm like, yeah, it's a bit of a, you know, I was like, oh, it's a bit far away and blah, blah, blah. And he just did, yeah, oh, you fucking pussy. Again, you know, like really just abused me about no going. I'm like, oh, fuck it, I'll go then. You know, that inspired me to go skateboarding. And I kind of needed that.
I
You
do
know,
like.
sometimes you need people to slap you around the face a bit and go, come on, get off your ass, fucking do this.
I do like Greg's emphasis towards that kind of pushing you to skate.
That's what it always used to be, though. Back in the day, you would do that. You'd give your mates abuse so that they skated with you or they carried on or they pushed themselves. And now we're approaching a time where people are afraid to do that because what someone else might think. You know, like I could be a session with you. Come on, Rob, you twat, fucking make it. And someone might go, oh, I saw Sean Goff and he's really offensive because he was telling this poor guy, Rob, who's obviously something wrong with him because he looks a bit slow and he was being really aggressive against him. You know what I mean? See that now, someone's probably going, oh, Sean just called Rob slow on his podcast. That's really offensive. I'm going to tweet that. Unfortunately, we're in this generation now, whereas before it was like, just fucking make it, you can't. You know, you had a bit of aggression in you, because that's what skateboarding can be quite aggressive.
That's what I liked about the
The
Vert
act of
series.
skateboarding is aggressive. Yeah. Well, just
Yes.
the act of skateboarding is aggressive anyway. You attack things, you know, you grind things. You ollie and it bang, slapping your tail, slapping your axles, you know. You fall off, you it's an aggressive form of sport, you know.
Definitely. 100%. And that brings me on nicely to the next question, which I wanted to bring up anyway, but I knew it had been asked, so I didn't bring it up. But Joe Hinson has put frontside indie.
Yeah, well, Joe Hinson could probably do a frontside indie into a backside nose blunt slide, which is actually really just the normal blunt side. Joe Hinson's.
I will never forget the first time. I'm not sure I've already brought this up, but the first time I got the chance to MC a vert series was at Adrenaline Alley, and I said frontside indie, and you. I remember you came up the stairs, you walked over to me, and you went, "If you say frontside indie again, Rob, I'm taking that mic off you."
Oh, I should have just slapped you. No, but it's true. It's wrong. It's like you're bastardizing history. You're bastardizing someone's language, you know? There's no such thing as a frontside indie. The only reason people call it frontside indies is because of the Tony Hawk video game. Or Tony Hawk's video game, as you often call Tony Hawk's, Tony Hawk's.
Tony Hawk's and...
Because nobody really heard of that dude.
He's in Stroudy as well.
Let me just explain this one. This is for Joe Hinson, so he realizes, because he should know this. The whole blunt side, backside tail slide thing, yeah? Now, the reason street skaters get it wrong is because they're street skaters. The whole point is if you're doing it on a spine, you're starting off in a certain way. It's always the way you come in. It should be always the way you're coming in. If you're doing a blunt slide and coming in and you're coming in over the top of the rail, then to me, it's a tail slide. But to street skaters, yeah, they can call it a blunt slide, I'd like, you know. It's like, oh, I ride a beer bicycle. Yeah, but it's got stabilizers on. Joe Hinson just needs to learn to do stuff properly.
On to the next one. You've still got a number of questions. Lots of questions coming.
Hang on, so I still can't carry on having a go at Joe Hinson.
Oh, go on. Yes, for sure.
No, I can't, to be honest with you. To be honest, it's quite fun. Okay, this is it's kind of one of those funny things I think about skateboarding is I don't really know Joe. I've met him a couple of times. I'm pretty sure I've never said a single word apart from, right, and that's it. But he's one of those guys who always interacts in some of the Facebook groups. So he's kind of like one of those guys that I feel I know, but I don't really know.
The weird world of social media these days.
Yeah, that's just the way it is.
Next one. We've got it in from Ben Grove, Champagne Super Grovers. That question is, what's his most favourite video part of all time?
Ooh.
It's a good one.
It's a good one. But I don't watch videos anymore. Bob Burnquist Dreamland.
Super good.
That's really ridiculously good. Yeah, that was like so... groundbreakingly, this can never be bettered, and it's kind of proved that as well, because that resurfaced the game like after 10 years and it was still, oh my god, this is insane. So yeah, I'd say that's probably the best video part that's been out there.
What was your favorite trick in that, if you can remember any? I mean, all of it was mind-blowing.
All of it's ridiculous. Just like the rewind grind on the goalposts, stuff like that, you know, like half cab grind popping into fakie where his front foot's flapping away. I mean, there's just so much that was just never been done at that fucking standard, you know, that height, that it was just insane. So, yeah, the whole section is just so ridiculously good. And it's kind of why that Danny Way never ever came out with another video part, if you think about it.
He didn't jump a bigger wall.
I always remember, yeah, well, basically, he did the jump in the wall thing. But Danny Way, you know, he built that mega ramp type thing in Hawaii and all that stuff. And all the DC videos like, yeah, Danny's park coming soon. And poor old Danny must have been at home, you know, like, yeah, I'm stacking clips. And then Bob comes out and he's like, oh, shit. And this just probably happened for him over and over and over again. Because, yeah, that part just destroyed anything else that had ever been done on Mega Ramp and pretty much anything since, you know?
Next question, which I absolutely love. Why have you never been a character in the Tony Hawk's Pro Skater game?
Because I've never been offered.
Most straightforward answer ever.
You know why? You went, this is a question that I really love. And I'm thinking... then I'm just going to give him such a shit answer.
It's just something that I've always thought. If he really,
it's also true. What am I supposed to say? You know, what else am I supposed to say? You know, oh yeah, you know, the lawyers were drawing up contracts, you know, and I was after 8 figures, but Tony would only offer 7. And although Activision offered to sell one of their Lear jets, you know, just couldn't get the numbers right. Plus, at the time, digital graphics weren't that good. And when you've got a face like mine, you've got to show it off to the best, to its best. So until they could really up their game on digital graphics, I didn't really want to be out there, you know.
It's a lot of hair.
It would just disappoint my fan base.
It's a lot of hair to process.
Yeah, exactly. How can you get these strands flowing in the wind? See, now I've just ruined it by giving you an answer to the question.
On to Blackwell's question. Lee Blackhell. My phone's gone off. Lee Blackhell's question. What was your personal favourite graphic when on Deathbox?
Oh, that's quite good. Not the tarot card, but the sun. Sun with a prism underneath it and stuff like that. That was my favourite graphic. I never got to choose the graphics ever. It's what people don't really realise from back then. I don't know if we mentioned it earlier when we were talking about Deathbox, because that was a few days ago. But yeah, I never got to pick any of the graphics. They just kind of were there and that's it. And I was like, yeah.
Haven't you got
I
that
like
one
that
tattoo?
Graphic the best. No, the one that's on my back is the one from the mini graphic, which is just like a tarot card. But the graphic on the board was slightly different from the graphic on the sticker, weirdly.
Do you know why?
I had a graphic on a T-shirt and a sticker that was based roughly on a graphic that was on a deck.
What? Why were they different?
Don't ask me. Jeremy, just, yeah.
Final question, although please remind me, someone messaged and they didn't know how to put in, they didn't know how to type into the response box, which I found hilarious. Final question, which I hope is the final question. John O'Zero's one's response. Wicksteed Park or Nebworth?
Nebworth. Yeah, definitely. See, I'm just looking at your face and you're like, I have no idea what this question is or anything, but maybe Sean will answer something interesting.
And I can look like
yeah, Nebworth, because you... Yeah, there was more naked chicks running around at Nebworth than Wicksteed. So you're looking at me again like, seriously? And no, dude, it wasn't like that. Wicksteed Park was an old skate park in Kettering, which had a big 16-foot deep bowl, but it was like not vert and big rounded lip. But Nebworth was really good. Like the bowl at Nebworth was totally skateable. There's some clips of me riding it in the Deathbox video. Nebworth, definitely Nebworth. And there probably was more boobs at Nebworth as well, because they had rock festivals at Nebworth.
Dare I say, you're gonna want to slap me, but dare I say, what location are both of them? I'm assuming they're in the UK.
Well, okay,
never heard of either.
Okay, that's fine. It's kind of complicated to describe where the locations were, but Nebworth was in Nebworth, and Wicksteed was in Wicksteed Park in Kettering.
Kettering.
Oh, it's a bit complex. Yeah.
And the other one, what was the
county? Nebworth was, I don't know the county. Nebworth was it's near Stevenage, so North Londonish area, I guess. St. Neots, sort of. I don't know. Google Maps. Just try Google Maps, Rob. You're not going to go there, so it doesn't really matter, does it? Let me just say, it's the arse end of Scotland. Yeah? Could be there. You don't care. No one's going to look.
I've just been looking. I found the question, which I actually couldn't find in the question boxes. So I hope that it's not a repeat. But this... Oh, it is. It's Will Paris. He said, who's inspired you? We have done that one. And what motivates you? So we have covered that. Thank God. So I've covered all the questions. I love it that they couldn't put it in the question box. They direct messaged me. I was like, I'm not going to remember to do that. And I have. And I've already asked it. So that's good times. Final. Do you have any shout-outs, Sean? And thank you ever so much. This has been a really good chat.
Shout outs, not really. No, just thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. If you've got this far, I'm quite amazed, because although I'm amazing, you're going to have to deal with Rob as well. Shout out to my parents. Without them, I'd be nothing. I really love my parents. I'm lucky and fortunate that they're both still there, and they've both been really supportive of my skating. Although they never hardly watched me skating or went anywhere skating with me. They've been supportive of the fact that I still want to skate. Obviously, Claire, love of my life. My son, Otis. Grandson, Chase. Just shout-outs to all my mates. Blah, blah, blah. I said they'd do no shout-outs, and I've just done loads of shout-outs, so I'm kind of contradictory.
I tell you what,
everybody.
You've mentioned your parents, and now I want to ask 1,000 questions about your parents. So no doubt I will definitely get you on the podcast again, because... there's so many other questions I wanted to ask, but I'm trying to keep these podcasts within the hour space, and this is already probably an hour and a half. So I'm going to say...
probably more than that.
Perfect. Well, thanks ever so much, Sean. It's been a really good chat. It's been super interesting, as I skate with you quite a lot, to like with Eddie, to get these kind of questions that I've never really thought about asking whilst I'm skating with you, because you don't do a front side in the air on a vert, and then I'm like, oh, Sean, when was your death box graphic out?
Yeah, but isn't that like everything with skateboarding? You hang out with you know people from skateboarding, but you don't know really what they do. Like, how many people do I know? I don't even know what their jobs are. Not that jobs are really important, but that's a major part of their life because they do it for so long. Like, you don't know how many kids they've got or if they've got kids. You know, it's quite weird how you can be friends with people for decades yet know nothing about them. Absolutely nothing.
Part of skating as well, though, is escapism and forgetting about maybe parts of your life you don't want to be talking about whilst you're skating.
I guess so. Well, plus when you're skating, you just skate, don't you? You have little jibber jabbers in between, but if I go skating, I want to go skating. You kind of save the rest for the car journey on the way there or on the way back, or if you're staying somewhere overnight somewhere.
Yeah, perfect. Well, thanks again, Sean. Two-part podcast in one. I'll leave you to your evening. Absolutely awesome conversation.
How much, Rob?
Cheers, Sean.
Bye then. This is bye-bye for real bye, yeah? Not webcast bye.
Yeah.
Just checking.
Yeah. I'm going to leave this in. This is brilliant.
Check these things. No, you could still be recording it thinking, I'm waiting for that bastard to say something really controversial. And I'll fucking have him then.
Wow. That was Sean Goff. I was really looking forward to that conversation. And hopefully you've heard why. Really, really interesting character. 57, I believe, years old. Still skating better than I can and ever will. And many people in their skateboarding abilities during their lifetime. Wow. Super good. Super good interview. If you haven't already, give us a subscribe on YouTube, Spotify, Apple, wherever you're listening to this. Give us a comment on YouTube. Give us a... if there's a poll, I've tried to keep this as simple as possible now and do as minimal editing as possible. So again, if you're on YouTube, send us a comment and check out the Instagram at thewineclub.sbs and send us an Instagram message to let us know how you've found this episode. Episode 10, I believe. Sean Goff, The Wine Club. Thank you ever so much for listening.
Who are you guys working for?
Who is this?
It's Skate Wine.
Oh, beautiful. Did you say Skate Wine?
Yes, sir.